You are listening to the Cycling Podcast with Lionel Burney, Daniel Freeb, and Richard Moore.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney. Hello, Lionel.
Hello, Richard.
Hello. It's just the two of us at the start this week, but it's basically part two of our press conference following the Grandest Tour. So answering your questions in this episode will be myself, Lionel, Daniel Freeb, Lizzie Banks, Ian Boswell, Francois Thomazeau, and also Alexander Christophe and Mitch Docker answering one of your questions. They had particular knowledge of the subject to hand, so we asked them, and so we'll hear from them. Before we get into the news roundup, though, at the start of this week's episode, a little announcement. Some of you, many of you, are friends of the podcast. Thank you very much indeed if you've signed up as a friend. We went onto a new system last December, and basically it's like Netflix now, isn't it, Lionel? You sign up and you get access to everything that's on our feed.
You do indeed, yes. A year's subscription gets a year's access, of course. And the model remains more or less the same. Your support, if you choose to become a friend of the podcast, is absolutely vital for us to be able to go off and cover the grand tours and the classics and deliver the episodes in addition to the regular cycling podcast. So everyone who does sign up to listen to the Friends of the Podcast episodes is directly supporting us and enabling us to deliver a year's worth of free episodes. So when the renewal process starts in the beginning part of December, I think the first people signed up last year, the Eager Beavers, signed up in early December. Hopefully everyone will be minded to renew and carry on supporting us for 2021. But there's lots of episodes on there, isn't there?
24 at the moment. And most recently, just today as we speak, we've just released Introducing Orla Shinawy. That's my conversation with Orla, the latest in a series where we interview each other. And it's Orla's entire life in journalism, going back to newspapers in Scotland, to local radio, local telly, Sky and Eurosport, where she now obviously presents the three grand tours. And it was really interesting. I thought I knew Orla, but lots of really interesting stuff in there. Last week we also released Tao's Giro. That was Tao Geoghegan-Hart basically talking us through his win at the Giro d'Italia. We're working on a very fun episode just now, which will come out in a couple of weeks. And I suppose the other headline, Lionel, and we will get onto the news in a moment, the other headline is a price freeze yet again. Just £15 for a year's subscription to the Friends of the Podcast episodes. If you do want to support us a little bit more and pay either £50 or £100, obviously that's greatly appreciated. You also get a gift. And we have a couple of fantastic new gifts. A tea towel and a casquette, a cap. And if you pay £100, you get both. If you pay £50, you get your choice of whichever one you want. These will be for sale at some point as well. But the tea towel is a work of art, isn't it?
It really is a work of art, yes. The artist behind it, Simon Scarsbrook, people will be very familiar with his work if they've... Well, he did the original jackets for the Cycling Anthology book series a few years ago. His work has also appeared in lots of the magazines, including Ruler. He's got a great style and, well, as you'd expect for a tea towel, an essential item for the kitchen, all of the little illustrations on it are... culinary references from the Cycling Podcast, aren't they, Rich? And we exclusively revealed the design to anyone who's subscribed to our newsletter last week, and I'll probably sneak it in there again this week. So if you sign up for the newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com, you can see the tea towel and cap that we're talking about.
Indeed. I don't know if duck and butter descending gels come under culinary, but we'll let that slide. But anyway, that's enough of the business. We're very grateful to all our friends of the podcast. And if you would like to sign up, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. Now, Lionel, do you have a news roundup for us, please?
I do indeed. Yes, a lot of news from the European Track Cycling Championships, which were held in Plovdiv in Bulgaria. Some familiar winners and some less familiar winners. A lot of success for the Russian team. 5 gold medals, 5 silvers and 3 bronze. They won the men's and women's team sprint and the men's team pursuit as well. Max Levy, who one of the best sprinters in the world, won both the sprint and Keirin for Germany. Ivo Oliveira, who was last seen in a couple of breaks at the Vuelta for UAE Team Emirates, won the individual pursuit for Portugal and teamed up with his twin brother, Rui, to ride the Madison, where they won silver behind the Spanish pair of Sebastian Mora and Albert Torres. But Great Britain topped the medals table with six golds. Matt Walls, who will be joining Bora Hansgrohe on the road next season, won the Omnium and Elimination race. And the British Endurance women's team won a medal in every event. They won the team pursuit, and Nia Evans won the individual pursuit, Katie Archibald won the points race, and Eleanor Barker won the elimination race. And there was also a silver for Laura Kenny in the Omnium and bronze for Kenny and Barker in the Madison. Elisa Balsamo, who won the recent Madrid stage of the Serra Tizit Challenge by La Vuelta, she won the Omnium ahead of Kenny and teamed up with Vittoria Guazzini to win the Madison. And another Italian with a name that might ring a bell for people who were watching cycling in the late 80s, Martina Fidanza won the scratch race for Italy. Her father is Giovanni Fidanza, who rode for Chateau Dax and won a stage of the 1989 Tour and also the points jersey in the Giro. Now, while it was a great week for Great Britain on the track, less good news off the track, because one of their coaches, Kevin Stewart, who was the head of the men's team sprint coaching team, was dismissed from his job last week. The reason for his sacking was a long-term pattern of inappropriate relationships with riders. So Kevin Stewart sacked with just under a year to go until the Tokyo Olympics. Some transfer news. Richard, I know you revealed that Lizzie Banks has signed for Serra Tizit WNT in the recent episode of the cycling podcast Feminine last week. But one item that didn't break in time for the last episode of the cycling podcast Feminine is that Chloe Dygert has signed a 4-year contract with Canyon SRAM. The 2019 World Time Trial champion is still recovering from her crash in this year's World Time Trial, of course, and it might be still a bit of a way to go in terms of her recovery, but a 4-year contract for Dygert at Canyon SRAM, Rich.
Yeah, the latest kind of marquee signing for that team, Pauline Ferrand-Prevot, was signed, and I guess she was a similar kind of star at the time, more focusing on mountain biking now, Pauline Ferrand-Prevot. But Chloe Dygert, obviously a great prospect. And it's not a transfer or signing without a little bit of controversy. She's released a statement. She did get some criticism around the same time as Quinn Simmons, the Trek Segafredo rider, who was actually suspended for some of his posts on social media, one in particular. And Chloe Dygert was identified as somebody who had liked various tweets and other posts that as Canyon SRAM put it, didn't fit with their values. And so Chloe Dygert released a statement saying that cycling should be for everyone regardless of colour, gender, sexuality or background. Like Canyon SRAM Racing, I am committed to promoting diversity, inclusion and equality in cycling and our wider communities. I apologise to those who felt offended or hurt by my conduct on social media. I'm committed to keep learning and growing as an athlete and a person. It's an interesting subject, this, and one I'm sure we will return to at some point over the winter.
Indeed. And some other transfer news. Well, we heard last week, just after we'd recorded, that Michael Valgren, who won Het Nieuwsblad in such impressive style a couple of years ago, he is joining EF Pro Cycling from NTT Pro Cycling. And well, the future of NTT Pro Cycling still hanging in the balance, but some reports today suggest that the team might be saved. A Cycling News reporting that Doug Ryder thinks that the team can continue with a new sponsor and an €8 million budget, which would be very low in World Tour terms, wouldn't it, for a year. But the team, well, it might be a way for the team to continue, albeit without Valgren, without Louis Menkes, who's going to Circus Wanty, Ben O'Connor's leaving to join AG2R Citroën as well. But still, you know, some riders may well be able to stay with the team if Doug Ryder manages to find that alternative sponsor. But he's been looking out for a way to save the team for, well, for some months now. And as we said last week, it's getting close to the point where they would have to confirm one way or the other whether the team is continuing. Alex Dowsett has extended his contract at Israel Startup Nation for another 2 years. No doubt his stage win at the Giro recently has plenty to do with that. And Harry Tanfield, another British rider who we've heard from in the podcast recently. He sent in a few audio diary dispatches from the Vuelta. Had to pull out of the race with an injury. He's dropping down to the Ribble Weldtight team, which will be run as sports director by Colin Sturgis, the former
friend of the podcast.
Friend of the podcast, Colin Sturgis, yeah, who former sports director with Madison Genesis, of course, but also a world pro individual pursuit champion in 1989, wasn't it? That was in Lyon.
Yep.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iWalker.co.uk. iWOCA.co.uk.
A big thanks to our title sponsor, iWalker. We are very grateful to iWalker for their support. If you run a small business and you're interested in finding out what iWalker might be able to do for you, go to iWalker.co.uk. You will see there that iWalker are credited to offer CBILS, that's the Coronavirus Business Interruption Loan Scheme, loans from £50,001 to £750,000, or flexi loans from £1,000 to £200,000, with decisions on those guaranteed in 24 hours. iWalker are also partnering with Mental Health UK to develop the UK's first ever mental health support programme designed specifically for small business owners. We're going to speak to iWalker about this programme in the coming weeks and hear a little bit more detail about it. Now, on with the questions in this second press conference episode. The first one is from Will Griffiths. And to answer it, we thought, rather than speculate ourselves, we'd ask a couple who should know. Alexander Christoph rides for UAE Team Emirates. He won the first stage of the Tour de France in Nice, remember, so he took the first yellow jersey. He also has four children. And Mitch Docker, the EF pro cycling rider, who has two kids. Why it's relevant that they have kids will become apparent when we hear Will's question.
Hi guys, it's Will Griffiths here in Shropshire. Thanks very much for the coverage of the Grand Tour this year, as well as all the other coverage. It's been most welcome in this rather strange year. My question focuses on the reaction of athletes to the first lockdown period and how it correlates with how their family responsibilities might correlate with their performance in the season when it got started again. I'm just thinking about those athletes who've had a longer career, who perhaps saw that lockdown as an opportunity to spend time with their family or their children, versus those athletes who could see it as a time of being entirely focused and selfish around their own training and performance. I know Valverde has sort of dropped off a cliff this year. I understand he has a young family, and I compare that with perhaps Theo Gegenhardt, who, as far as I'm aware, doesn't have any children, and therefore responsibilities for childcare and sharing the burden of that, etc. So just keen to know your thoughts on whether you've seen any patterns that I might not have spotted. Cheers.
It will be easier, of course, to go training camps and altitude training without a family, and I think that makes it maybe easier if you are single to do more dedicated training like that, to be away from home and just be in hotels everywhere because there's nobody at home waiting for you. But actually, I never did altitude training my whole career. I was always training in the lowland, or what do you call it. I just focus on training normal, like always. I kind of trained a little bit like off-season training in the lockdown and like I do in the winter. So it was just a really long winter.
You're used to juggling family and training.
Yeah, and my wife is also doing most of the work, I will say, with the kids. So I'm kind of lucky.
You're famous for doing very long training rides as well.
Yeah, I train quite a lot in hours. So So it's not always the best way or easiest way to do together with some kids, of course.
It explains the long training rides. Well, it sounds like you've got the kids in the background there, so I'll let you deal with them. And thanks very much for your time, Alexander. Yes.
I think there's two answers to this question. I think initially I thought it was harder having children in lockdown. This is not talking about the cycling side of things, but psychological side of things. But in the long run, I think it was better having children because we had a real purpose in our day-to-day life, you know, playing games with the kids, organizing things for the kids to do. By the time, you know, 8 o'clock came around, the kids were down. I really felt like I'd achieved something in the day opposed to just trying to get through a day. But I do agree with what we've seen, this change of the tide, you know, the young peloton coming through. And look at this year, all the young guys are flying. Look at the Giro, you know, look at the Vuelta even. So there is something in that. I don't know whether we as parents got more worn out, and as the season kicked off, we were on the downward spiral and the young guys were just feeling a bit fresher and ready to go. So I don't have any actual data for that, but I do see what they're getting at there. I think it is there is an element of that change of the tides, you know. But what is it like having kids at home and training in general outside of lockdown? It's just a lot more regimented, you know. Cycling has very much transitioned into a job that I love to do, different to, say, a passion that I used to have it as. Now it's like daddy's going to work and I get out there, do my work and get home because I know I'm needed back at home, opposed to sort of stopping for two or three coffees out there and eventually getting home sometime in the afternoon.
And what about, I mean, did you try and get away? Because I know you went up into Andorra as well. Was that to try and just make training work rather than, you know, have to have competing demands on your time? And also, you know, if you're not at home to help, it gives that little bit of separation. Whereas when you are at home to help, the expectation is to muck in with the kids as well.
It's exactly that. I thought if I'm going to be training, I might as well just get away and do it. And then when I'm home, what I was doing is just being up there for 5 days and coming 5 weekdays and then coming home for the weekends, because I knew that I could have two easy days and that way I could just be around and be around home and be present in the moment with the kids and the family. And when it was time to train, I was like, it's just better for me to disappear and get my training done at 100% rather than just trying to do everything a little bit in that medium.
Hi, Cycling Podcast. My name is Andrew from Danville, California, home of Mount Diablo and numerous tours of California. Do you think the change in the pro calendar and Grand Tour races due to COVID will have any lasting effect on the calendar? Thinking in terms of people like Primoz Roglic up near the top of two of the Grand Tours, and whether somebody could sustain themselves for multiple Grand Tours or maybe even all three near the top if they were pushed closer together and ran back to back.
Hello, lads of the Cycling Podcast. My name is Logan Jones-Wilkins from Richmond, Virginia. How do you think this condensed, weird pandemic season has changed the landscape for racing scheduling going forward? Personally, I felt like I really enjoyed the engaging and eclectic nature of the season this year, and I was just wondering what your take was on it. Are certain races going to grow in stature? Are certain races going to go by the wayside? And might we see some different races in different portions of the season in the future?
Hi guys, it's Jim Cotton here. Just a quick question for all or any of you. So next year, if you, in a dream world, if you could keep any one aspect of this year's calendar, whether it be, for example, a summer Strada Bianche or a Ardennes Classics coming before the Flanders Classics, what would you keep and why?
Well, three questions there, all along a similar theme from Andrew, Logan and Jim. Thanks very much for your questions. And it's, well, this season that we've just lived through, and the changes imposed by the pause in racing thanks to COVID, is there anything we'd keep? Are there any lessons from what we've just had What one aspect of this year's calendar would you keep? We covered this at some length in our last episode of the Grandest Tour. Actually, Lionel and I talked about this, and Lionel also covered it in the latest newsletter. If you want to sign up to our newsletter, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. So I don't want to go over it again, but my one thing I would keep is have some meaningful races after the Tour de France for riders who've come out of the Tour. To perhaps, you know, Liège-Bastogne-Liège was brilliant this year because it was a sort of Tour revenge match, and you know, there were reasons for guys like Roglic and Pogacar to keep racing after the Tour. Often we don't see riders who've starred in the Tour again. The season kind of fizzles out. So that would be the one thing I would keep.
The one thing I would keep is I would move the Vuelta another month back and have it in October, just to give it that bit of distance from the Tour, to enable Richard your run of post-Tour classics and the World Championships to be right at the kind of peak of the season, and to kind of redefine the Vuelta as that you know, that post-Tour you know, opportunity for revenge matches, riders who, I mean, it already is anyway, but you could perhaps also redraw the Vuelta as almost the sort of the beginner's Grand Tour, and perhaps even have some kind of rule which, again, this is something that's happened organically this year and does happen. You know, lots of riders make their Grand Tour debut in the Vuelta, don't they? But maybe make it a formal thing and say that two of your riders have to be, you know, first or second year pros or making their Grand Tour debut, just to basically broaden the opportunity for young riders. You know, I think that might be something that the sport could look at. I don't know. But Daniel, what would be the one thing you'd keep from this sort of strange mixed up calendar?
I wouldn't disagree with any of that. I think, as Rich says, Liège and, well, that whole Ardennes block off the Tour would make a lot of sense. I'd also throw in, as I think I mentioned in the podcast before, Strade Bianche in that slot in August. So actually, it was in July, wasn't it, this year? It was before
August the 1st.
But I thought it suited a summer position much better. And yeah, the Vuelta as well, Napalm, although I think its proximity to the Tour de France added another dimension to it. I must say, I would have balked at the idea before this year of any reduction in the length of the Grand Tours. But there was something quite sort of, well, not symmetrical, but there was something quite neat and concise about the 18-day Grand Tour, three sets of six stages. I thought it made a lot of sense. Commercially, it might make less sense because the Grand Tour organisers like to have four weekends, because the weekends are the kind of big ticket days. But I thought 18 stages was a lot less daunting for the riders and for everyone involved, and it created the conditions for more aggressive racing. The other thing, which is not really an offshoot of, not really related to COVID, but the Vuelta this year almost dispensed with nailed on sprint stages. There was always somewhere where the sprinters and their teams really had to earn the right to sprint. And unfortunately, you know, we're so accustomed, we're so hardwired to just accept this big block of sort of six or seven sprint stages in Grand Tours. I think that should possibly be questioned, particularly in light of the fantastic Vuelta we saw.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
Well, that's the voice of Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, of course, interrupting this episode to remind me to tell you that it is sponsored by HelloFresh. Now, what have you been cooking up in the kitchen, Lionel?
Well, Richard, you know me. I love cooking. I love eating even more than the cooking.
Which do you love more, cooking or eating?
I think...
Silly question.
I think when I'm using the HelloFresh recipe box, I actually really enjoy the process of following the recipe and all of the sort of the difficult bits about cooking, such as choosing what to have, going and getting all of the right ingredients and prepping all of the right ingredients is sort of minimized, really. It boils it down to the most enjoyable bit, which is actually putting the dish together and creating the meal from scratch, but with all the measuring and weighing all taken out of the equation. And you're never going to the cupboard and thinking, oh, well, we haven't got any turmeric or we haven't got any chili flakes left, and making the recipe with bits missing. That's because the HelloFresh box arrives with everything you need for your week's meals. You can have up to 5 meals a week for up to 4 people, and everything comes already measured out for you. All the ingredients are fresh. All you have to do is the peeling and the chopping and the cooking. Follow the easy instructions on the cards. And well, on Saturday night we had pork and apple burgers with some rosemary topped potato wedges and a little side salad, and very tasty it was too. If you want to sign up and try HelloFresh for yourself, you can get 50% off your first HelloFresh box and 35% off your next 3 with the code cycling at hellofresh.co.uk. that's cycling. That's the code to get 50% off the first box and 35% off the next 3 at hellofresh.co.uk. Unfortunately, Rich, I don't think they deliver to France.
No, I've been struggling in France to cook, partly because it's all unfamiliar. You get into a sort of groove at home of knowing where things are, what they look like, the brands that you like in the supermarket. And I'm still feeling my way here, I'm afraid. We've got all the veg in the garden, but this is my excuse for not having really got into my stride cooking.
All of that supermarket shopping is taken out of the equation with HelloFresh. You just,
in case Francoise listening, it's not a dig at French cuisine at all, I promise.
Yeah, you don't have to queue at the supermarket. You just get everything turns up in a box. And one of the things that I particularly like about it is that there's no waste. I don't want a joke or a dig here, Richard. There's very little waste when food's put in front of me anyway. What I mean is you're not buying, a large quantity of something and only using a third of it in a particular recipe. Everything is weighed and pre-portioned for you. So lots of advantages.
Well, come on, HelloFresh, get Bonjour Fresh set up here in France.
Hi guys, Chris Buck here in Glasgow. Thanks for your consistently interesting and insightful analysis of these 3 gripping grand tours. To my question, I understand it's long been a convention in professional cycling that all the cash bonuses won by the team go into a pot to be shared out with all. But what about people who leave the race early through illness or injury? So someone like Superman, who left in this stage 1 of the Giro, would he have got his full share of the Astana kitty? Can you please clear that one up for me? Thanks.
Thanks for the question, Chris. So every team has a different rule for prize money. And at the beginning of the year, you agree to how you want the prize money situation to run. Normally, when every rider that starts a race will take a share of the prize money. Of course, with the Grand Tours, it's quite different because it's a 3-week long race. And so if you crash out on stage 2 or stage 1 like Superman, then of course, it's a very, very long race to where you're not involved in the race. But, you know, we've had situations where a rider has crashed out halfway through a stage race and then we've included the rider in the prize money. I think in this situation with Superman, because it was stage 1 and that was a time trial and then he had no impact on the race at all, or, well, he did have an impact by the fact that he wasn't there, but, you know, he wasn't contributing to the race. Whether or not the team rules say that he would have been able to get the prize money, I would imagine he would say, I don't want the prize money for this race. But yeah, it really depends on the situation of the team. And, you know, sometimes the rider will say, you know, I don't want to be part of it. But I've had a situation where the rider says, we don't want to be part of it. And actually we say, don't be stupid. You were an incredibly, you know, important part of this team's success up to the point where you crashed, and you would have been if you weren't there. So they get included in the prize money anyway.
Hey Chris, that's a great question. The split of prize money amongst riders is oftentimes decided prior to the season. The riders will sit down at the first or second training camp of the year and decide how they're going to split prize money. If someone drops out after the first 50% of the race, maybe they won't get it. Other teams say that if a rider starts the race, they're part of the prize money. That probably is dictated by the team you're on. Obviously, a team like Ineos or Quickstep, they're going to be making a fair chunk of change from prize money, so they don't mind splitting it amongst everyone who starts. At Katusha, I believe we said that a rider had to finish 50% of a race. There are always, you know, certain situations where a rider will be incorporated in the prize money. For example, they crash out early in a Grand Tour with a broken collarbone or something, and it's kind of something beyond their control. And to that, normally one portion of prize money is also added, or one position of prize money is also added to the split of the prize money. For example, if there's 8 riders on a Grand Tour, the prize money will be split 9 ways, and that 9th portion of money is then split between the staff members. Usually senior management is not involved in that split, so it would go to mechanics, chefs, soigneurs, and maybe people back home and at their office who are looking over travel and such. So that is more or less how riders split prize money. But that said, depending on what team you're on, prize money can either add up to be a significant amount of money, or it can be a relatively small amount. I do know that the year prior to going to Team Sky, their policy was that all the prize money over the whole year was split amongst every rider. And that was 2012 when that happened, and all the riders on the team got a pretty good bonus at the end of that year. That was never the case when I was on the team, so I was only able to take home prize money for races that I was a part of and races that I finished.
Hi, greatly enjoyed the Grandest Tour, so thank you for all the tour coverage this year. And I know there have been various challenges in terms of conducting interviews, and we've heard much of Daniel's trials and tribulations when it comes to food as well. So I wondered if you might indulge yourselves with explaining what would be your ultimate Grand Tour dinner, perhaps where it would be, what dishes you'd order, butter pie, presumably Lionel, and which 3 Grand Tour riders you would invite along for their compelling conversation.
Obviously, an ideal dinner for me would be at Le Viscose. I usually have an ideal dinner on most Tour de France at Le Viscose. We didn't have one in the last tour, but Le Viscose, I've said it many, many times now, everybody should know about it, is a hotel and restaurant at the foot of the Tourmalet, facing Hautacam and not far from Aspin, and all these famous mountain passes with, one of the richest and tastiest foods available in the area and in most parts of France. So it's full of cycling fans, full of cyclists as well, who go to tackle the surrounding passes, and they have a gravel. I mean, one of the sons of the landlord is also a gravel bike fan and has a big gravel bike club there. So it's, only good things at Le Viscose. And I've seen many, many riders and cycling people there, so I've had dinner with a couple of former GT riders at Le Viscose. But I suppose my ideal dinner in general would be to have their pommes au foie gras et boudin noir de Bigorre, which is their ultimate recipe that the landlord took away from his learned from his grandmother. So it's apple, it's baked in the oven, and inside the apple you have foie gras and black pudding made by the local pork and the local pigs called Noir de Bigorre, and that's very tasty, as Richard would say, and delicious. The melting of fat, sugar, and a little bit of spice in there as well. It's obviously not light, but it's really, really cool. And and ideally, I would have that kind of dinner, with Madiran. That's the wine that usually you have with this, and which is also quite tasty and strong wine. Ideally, I think I would have that kind of dinner with former GT riders who like their food, and I'll probably do that with Raphaël Geminiani, who is now more than 90 years old, but is still alive, and was probably the best bon vivant in the peloton. Always liked his food, his wine, and his fun with friends, and food, women, and songs, as they said in his days. And he's always been a great, very witty, interesting person. Eddie Merckx, I've seen in many, many restaurants, is really, really probably as good, if not better, as a bon vivant and, you know, and a cannibal, as he was nicknamed in the restaurant at a dinner table than he was in the saddle. So Merckx, Jim Mignani would be nice. And I don't know why. I think I would have Stephen Roach in there with the rest of them for the little nasty remarks from time to time, and you know, discussing the old days with wit and kind of a gentle cynicism. If I had to pick another table, it would be interesting to have Greg LeMond and Bernard Hinault at the same table discussing the old days over at Le Viscose, over a bottle of Madiran and various you know, Pyrenean meals. If I had to pick current riders, I would probably go with Nathan Haas, because I mean, he's always good company, and he knows his food, and I think, you know, the chef there, Alexis, would be delighted for Nathan to, you know, kind of draw and design the menu, and Alexis would do it his way. I would take Romain Bardet for the wine, because he's a wine expert, he knows what he's doing, and probably Thomas de Rennes for the fun. And that would be a good combination, I think. I think that's it. And maybe lastly, for the digestive, because usually you have Armagnac outside in the courtyard. I would have the digestive with Bradley Wiggins, Chris Froome, and Geraint Thomas discussing the old days at Team Sky. Why not? It could be fun.
Well, I was going to say Le Viscose, Richard, but Francois, I mean, that's his home, isn't it, really? He was very kind to introduce us to it. Daniel, I was an Italian alternative which has potential. I was very much looking forward to going back to the restaurant in Barbaresco, where we had a very good meal, and I'd quite like to go there with Max Chiandri. And you, Daniel, you know, you can, and Richard, obviously Richard as well. Sorry.
What an afterthought.
And I say that because when I spoke to Max for our Giro, and he was talking about, you know, what he was enjoying about lockdown, and he talked for so long about just the ritual of having a relaxed and simple lunch every day, and how much he was enjoying that aspect of being at home. Just made me think, yeah, a long lunch or a nice dinner at in Barbaresco would be nice. Maybe the Giro route will go back there. Next year or the year after, hopefully.
Well, I was at that very restaurant just before I left for the Giro, in fact.
I saw your photos. Yeah, I was very envious.
Yes. Ideal meal for me, chaps. I'm going to go for contemporary riders. I'd like Rog there for his conversation. And no, I actually would like Rog and Thibaut Pinot, because I would like some of the Rogness to rub off on Thibaut. I'm slightly worried about him. Abandoned the Vuelta after 3 days and had an absolutely disastrous season, and still suffering with the back problems that he had at the Tour de France. A bit reminiscent of the knee problems he had at last year's Tour. The issue hasn't really been diagnosed, or there hasn't been a very clear diagnosis yet. And Rog and Pinot couldn't be more different, could they? You feel as though Rog would still be sprinting for time bonuses in a nuclear war. And
wow.
Yeah. Have you chaps managed to catch up on any of the Jumbo-Visma videos of the Vuelta? They've done a bit of a three-part documentary of the Vuelta. Much like, I suppose, the Movistar documentary on Netflix, you get sort of snatches of just sort of glimpses into life in the team and people's real character. But yeah, some, you know, very typical sort of demeanor and attitude Rog clearly brought into the Vuelta. He just sort of rocked up saying, "Oh, we see how it goes." And then, of course, you know, standing there three weeks later with the red jersey. Third member, who actually would be for his conversation because he was hilarious at the Vuelta, Harry Tanfield. Of AG2R. And the meal, it would be strictly Italian, a nice fresh panzanella salad, bread salad to start, Umbricelli alla Norcina, black truffle and sort of sausage, Umbrian pasta dish. Then a nice light carpaccio for secondo, for main meat course.
I mean, if we...
With a nice Nebbiolo, maybe a Barbaresco from someone like the Produttori del Barbaresco. That's a good Barbaresco.
And a cappuccino to finish it all off. Yeah, exactly. If we can go historic, I'd go out for lunch with the G4, Coppi, Cobley, Kubler and Bobby of the 1950s, because I was always very taken by the description of them and their kind of film star lifestyles by Jean Bobby in his book Tomorrow We Ride. They were the first kind of modern cyclists, and they had a great life. They'd probably turn up in their... Well, Bobby would fly there in his own plane. Coppi would be driven by the White Lady. And it would be a very glamorous setting on the Côte d'Azur, I imagine. And we'd have a wonderful afternoon lunch, spilling into dinner, I think.
Sounds like a you could imagine a sort of semi-factual lunch with episode, with some actors playing the parts of Coppi, Kubler...
Yeah, we could just get Daniel to make it all up.
So I share Francois' grief about the understandably morose and rudderless Johann Afredo. This got me wondering about what kinds of supports are in place for newly retired riders. I know you've done some great podcasts on retired riders in the past, but what struck me in particular was when Francois mentioned that Afredo found it hard to sleep at night because he was not appropriately wrung out at the end of the day. It's like his body and mind were calibrated to cycling's demands. But what happens when this ends? And given what we know about things like increased heart sizes and the mental health demands of the pro peloton, can we assume that doctors work with these ex-pros to help them transition back into having, I don't know, a more mortal body? And what do we know about the details of this or how it happens? And maybe the new cycling union should keep some money aside to help riders like Afredo land a little lighter on their feet when they leave the pro ranks. Anyway, keep up the great work. Cheers.
Kim, that's a great question. Unfortunately, to my knowledge, no, there is no resource for riders to seek help in their transition from rider to normal life. One of the unique challenges of pro cycling is that most riders, upon their retirement, need to enter the workforce in another capacity. And because there's no system in place to provide riders any sort of support, I feel like that's a reason why a lot of riders stay within the sport and become a director or a coach at a team, because that's the life and the experience that they have. On the financial side, the CPA does take 2% of all prize money from the racing that goes to a fund that eventually ends up in what is called the Transition Fund, which is for riders who have been racing for more than 5 years in the World Tour or Pro Continental level. They receive a one-time payment of €12,500. However, that fund is effectively at the moment bankrupt and there's no money. I was supposed to receive my Transition Fund this year. I applied to help pay for some schooling that I'm applying for. And I received a one-time payment of €3,000 and told that at the moment there is no money in that fund. And I don't know if there is going to be money in that fund because there is a new union being formed. And hopefully this new group of riders or ex-riders who have put this together can begin to address some of these issues.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
A question from Charles Gilbank for James Morton at Science and Sport. And it's a great question, actually. We've had a lot of questions from oldies like me, but this is at the other end of the age spectrum. Charles writes that his son trains and races. He is 14 and still growing. He sees the peloton with their gels, etc. What would you suggest for race and training food for a 14-year-old?
Well, again, I think this is another great question, Rich. So thanks, Charles, for sending that question in. Nutrition for adolescents at the minute is a real hot topic in the research literature. Without changing tack too much, actually, we've just published a study on academy footballers. What we were able to measure was the amount of calories that they were expending every day. And we were seeing that 12, 13-year-old footballers were expending just as much, if not more, calories than first-team players from the Premiership. And, of course, the problem with underfueling throughout adolescence, as you touch upon, is you're still growing. And this can be a real problem from your bones. Your bones don't really develop in the same way. So before we give the answer to this question, I just want to highlight to all the listeners that this is something that all adolescent athletes really need to pay particular attention to. And the, I guess the take-home message is to almost avoid what you see World Tour riders doing, because in that situation, they might be periodizing their energy intake. They'll have low-calorie days, high-calorie days. A young athlete can't afford to do that because they're growing all of the time. So every day should look the same for these guys, and the principles should be just really fueling well. Don't worry about weight loss, because you can run into problems. And in terms of fueling on the bike, you can keep it simple. Go back to whole foods. So you can use things like bananas. You can make your homemade sandwiches. You might use some energy bars, or even make your own energy bars using oats. And then as a recovery, I'll go back to that good old glass of milk that we were all told to consume during school. Milk's a great recovery drink. And again, from a bone perspective, of course, it has calcium, but it also has carbohydrate and protein. So I think really, Richard, it's about doing the basics consistently well and trying not to copy what truly elite athletes do, because at that stage in your life, you're not an elite athlete and your physiology is totally different.
Well, thanks very much indeed to Science and Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. And we heard there from James Morton, Director of Performance Solutions at Science and Sport and Professor of Exercise, Metabolism and Nutrition at Liverpool, John Moores University. James answering a listener's question there. Very interesting indeed. James has been fielding quite a few of your questions. If you have a question for him on nutrition, please email us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com and record your question as an audio file if possible, please. That would be great. If you'd like 25% off all your Science and Sport products, please go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code at the checkout, SISCP25. That's SISCP25. And Lionel, in response to last week's episode, we heard on our Facebook chat group from Stephen Moon, the Science and Sport Chief Executive, who is a regular, well, obviously a listener and a correspondent of ours.
We did indeed, yes. We were talking about whether supporters of professional cycling, or people who follow professional cycling, identify with teams in the same way that a football supporter would, and we kind of came to the conclusion that they don't, just sort of anecdotally really. But Stephen left a really interesting post on our Facebook page. I mean, I nearly switched off when he said, "I listened to the latest episode today while pulling 500 watts on Zwift."
Fake news.
I mean, he doesn't say for how long. But he said that Science and Sport obviously do periodic research in key markets on athletes and teams, and he's found that during this research, in some markets, there's virtually no interest in pro teams. So all of the identification is with individual riders. He says that Team Sky built up reasonable brand awareness over the years, but the move to Ineos has crushed that brand awareness. And I would hazard a guess, says Stephen, that the recent move to Grenadiers won't have helped. And I found that really interesting, to sort of the name of the team, such a strength for the sponsor in a lot of ways, but for the kind of the longer term health and strength of the team might actually, at some point be a hindrance, because the identity of the team is what? It is the name and the colours, isn't it? That's the bit we all identify with when watching and talking and reading about the sport. But it leaves the team itself with what? And that, I suppose, is where EF were quite clever with the Argyle motif, which went across several sponsors. But then once they'd settled down with EF recently, they ditched the Argyle motif and have gone for the most recent look is the skateboarding duck.
Yeah, no, it was really interesting. Quite a long post from Stephen, so there's quite a bit of detail there, and it has sparked quite an interesting discussion as well. Just before we go to our next question, a little update on the sales of mugs that were made by Stacey Snyder, the Cycling Podcast mugs, which we sell for good causes at the Grand Tours. We've raised, Stacey emails to write, $11,000 for charities this year. That includes $3,850 at the recent Vuelta and Giro combined. That money will go to the Black Cyclist Network in the UK and the Bahati Foundation in LA. So that's fantastic news, and we say big thanks to all of you who bought one of the beautiful, well, cappuccino sets, mugs or beer cups from Stacey, and of course a huge thanks to Stacey for all her hard work.
Hi, my name is James Robertson. I'm a friend of the podcast, currently living in Mexico City. My question was about some of the fun that gets poked at Lionel when he uses the phrase going backwards to describe someone falling out the back of the pack. And obviously one of the great things about the cycling podcast is the way you all get along and you rib each other a bit, and that kind of sense of camaraderie makes it for a very good listen. But while I'm no physicist, I did wonder whether Lionel might be right, and whether under the theory of relativity, perhaps those cyclists are going backwards relative to the pack, at least. And no doubt you have some very eminent physicists that listen to this show, and I just wondered whether that was something that could be cleared up, and that would maybe, you know, help defend Lionel from some of the ribbing he gets, and maybe prove him right. Who knows? Anyway, keep up the good work. Really enjoying the show. Thanks.
Thanks for your question, James. Well, I mean, that in defense of Lionel and his famous expression, well, common cycling vernacular, going backwards, to say that someone's going backwards. Is Lionel actually right when he says that?
I don't think so, but the language we use in cycling, as we talked about again at the end of the Grandest Tour, pedaling squares. I mean, doesn't people don't literally pedal squares, do they? But
well,
richer than saying that he was going forward slightly less quickly than the people in front, which is, you know, self-evident, really, isn't it? That's how bike racing works, I guess. But I'm trying to police myself from saying going backwards when, obviously, they're not really going backwards.
Hi, Cycling Podcast. This is Lucinda from Glasgow. My question is for Joe Dombrowski, or maybe one of the audio diarists. With the weather on the Vuelta being so terrible, how do the cyclists get their shoes dry? Do they have multiple pairs of shoes with them on a grand tour? Really interested to know.
Hey, Lucinda. Yes, nobody likes riding in wet shoes, but thankfully, most every rider on a grand tour should have at least three pairs of shoes with them. They'll have their race shoes that they traveled with from home, and they should have a pair of shoes in each of their rain bags, which follow behind the race in car one and car two. More often than not, riders like to use one pair of shoes throughout a grand tour, so they'll stay with their race shoes. And a little trick of the trade is when you finish a wet ride or race, take the insoles or orthotics out of your shoes and really stuff your shoes full of as much newspaper or hand towel as possible. Turn those shoes upside down, and ideally, if the weather is cold and wet, when you get to the hotel, the radiators in the hotel room will be on. Put those shoes on the radiator upside down, and hopefully by the morning, your shoes will be dry and ready for another stage.
You always have spare shoes with you. You have one pair that you race with and a spare pair in your rain bag, and sometimes riders will even have a third pair. But, you know, your cleats are never quite set up the same. As much as you try and, you know, you try to get them exactly the same, sometimes they're always different. And for me, when I put on my spare shoes, it's just that bit different, and I don't want to risk it. So I always stuff them with newspaper or I put them on the radiator. But, you know, years ago, I saw a video of a rider that has these infrared heaters that they pop in their shoes after a wet stage. And not only does it dry their shoes out, it also stops them smelling. So for years, I've been thinking I should really find out what they are and try and get my hands on one. But yeah, I mean, every team should have eight pairs of those, I think, because there's nothing worse than wearing soggy, smelly shoes the next day. I've been using Speedplay the past year, and so with Speedplay, it's not so hard because I just leave the base plate in the same place, and then I mark the position with a black marker of the top plate, and I also take a photo of it. So I've really got lots of things as references to be able to put it back on. With Shimano or Look cleats, it's kind of easy because you just use a marker pen once again to draw around the edge of the cleat. Then you take the old one off. And make sure you don't clean the shoe because any mud or anything really helps you to get it in exactly the same position. And then you pop the new one back on. And the key as well here is to not leave your cleats until they're absolutely ruined. Because the thing is, once they're really, really worn down, then there'll be so much float in them. And so then when you put the new cleats on, they'll really feel quite different. So try and keep on top of changing your cleats. And that will really help with when you change them over to, you know, for them to stop feeling quite so different. And also, when you do finally change them over, the golden rule is to not go out and do a really, really hard ride straight away. Go and do an easy ride. Let your body sink into the new cleats because, you know, although you think they're in the same place, they will be a tiny, tiny bit different. Have a really, really good stretch that evening. And then as long as you feel fine, then you can go and do your efforts.
Hello all, this is Richard in Milton Keynes. The initial idea for this question came to me while listening to Wednesday's discussion of the Tour de France route, where to eat, nipping into Andorra, and so on. I'd just read a press report of the expected queues at Channel ports after the Brexit transition period ends on January the 1st, a minimum of 2 hours, but much more in summer. And this led me to wonder how this would affect the ability of the podcast presenters to cover races across Europe. Then I realised, Richard has already made sensible family arrangements, presumably wholly with a view to residence rules, and Daniel's surely by now sufficiently European to exist incognito in any one of 4 or 5 countries. Which just leaves Lionel. I think there was talk of an Irish passport, but I haven't heard of any plans to relocate to Carcassonne or Bergamo to allow unfettered access to cycling and cuisine. Is a move on the cards, or can we expect expanded coverage of the Tour series, or maybe even the Sex Shop time trial in 2021? Thanks.
Well, thanks for your question, Richard. How will Brexit affect the cycling podcast? Well, in particular, Lionel. Lionel, are you going to be our man at the Tour Series next year? Maybe reporting on the Sex Shop time trial as well?
I do have an Irish passport. And, I mean, that will help once I'm in Europe. But it's getting Europe, you know, the EU bit of Europe. It could be interesting getting... Hopping across and back might not be quite as easy, but we really don't know how it will affect us, do we, at the moment? I mean, will you be allowed to stay in France, Richard? Will Daniel be allowed to, you know, hop from country to country as a British citizen?
Yeah, what are your arrangements going to be, Daniel?
I'm just going to ignore it. I've ignored it since day one. I'm going to continue to ignore it. I'm not going to dignify it with my, you know, with my attention.
Just carry on.
But I think we may have to leave for the, or I may have to leave for the tour a day earlier than usual, just in case. Who knows? But we're going to have to just adapt, aren't we?
But by this time next year, we will all be Irish, will we not?
Yeah, well, that's part of the plan. Although I've not had any response to my application for Irish citizenship, which I sent in almost a year ago. I know there have been other things going on. It's a busy time for governments and government departments, but if you're listening, Irish citizenship department,
they're just looking into why you were disqualified from the Ross. And
That's been the most documented disqualification in the history of cycling. So I don't have any problems getting to the bottom of that. Anyway, there were a couple of questions just before we go on time bonuses. Again, this was something we talked about a bit in the Grandest Tour. But I just wanted to get your take on it, Daniel. I was interested, linked to this in a way, because people throwing shade a little bit on Roglic's win at the Vuelta because he owed his win in part to time bonuses, perhaps. Also, you mentioned though that the Vuelta was only 18 days this year. Nobody, you know, it's amazing that has not seemed to affect. There's no sort of asterisk against the Vuelta for that reason. It's not affected the way that people have regarded it at all. It's not lessened the achievement in anyone's eyes. But what about the time bonus aspect? Do you think, I saw you launching a pretty vigorous defence.
Oh, this winds me up. This winds me up no end.
Good.
It really does.
Excellent.
Because I just see this fundamental contradiction of people emphasising, wanting to emphasise how complex and cycling is and the role of tactics and teams, yet there's this puritanical desire for the strongest rider, the strongest physical specimen to win every Grand Tour. And, you know, with no imponderables like tactics, like the weather, like anything else playing any role, which, as I say, to me has always seemed like a huge contradiction. Time bonuses, I think, have made racing much more exciting. And if you need an example of what happens when there are no time bonuses. Go back and watch certain stages from 2008 Tour de France, when inexplicably they were done away with for a year, and there were mountain stages where you got guys going down the road and then the GC riders just rolling in, completely disinterested in where they finished in the stage. And you know, the argument I've seen people make is that, well, you know, if there were no time bonuses, Roglic would be forced to attack earlier and not leave it to the last kilometer. Well, every other GC contender was at liberty to do that in the Vuelta and to cancel out you know, the perceived advantage that Roglic would have. And did they do it? In some cases they did, in some cases they didn't. But you know, there was there's this great antagonism that's set up between attack and defense. A rider who has the time bonuses in his favor and the others that don't. And you know, I think that sets up, that creates the conditions for great racing. You know, that the pressure is on those guys, the, in the Vuelta, the Hugh Carthys, the Carapazes, so forth, every day to thwart Rog. But the really fascinating thing I think about the time bonuses that are currently used in Grand Tours, the 10 seconds, is they're small enough for teams not to build a tactic or even a team around, but they're significant enough now, as we're seeing, to decide the race. And I think that Roglic gained 48 seconds in time bonuses, and I think you know, the blame, if you like, for that to some degree goes to Ineos. And this is what no one has really acknowledged, or no one did at the Vuelta, that so in six separate stages did he gain time bonuses. On none of those stages did Ineos, for example, put a guy in the break that day. And you know, that's what one of the key things that you can do to stop a guy like Roglic taking time bonuses, to make sure the break goes to the finish. And you know, that's not something a single rider can necessarily influence. Like, you know, if Dylan Van Baarle had been in the break on each one of those days, it's not a given that the break would have gone to the finish. But it's better than having no one in there. You know, having a strong guy like that, he will attract other strong guys, and you will increase the chances of the break going to the finish. Ineos don't put guys in breakaways generally when they're going for GC, and it strikes me that it's not something that they have thought a lot about. I mean, you know, I'm sure I could be shot down on that. I'm sure, you know, the counter argument could be that, well, they were two guys down very early in the Vuelta, with Goyash and Brandon Rivera pulling out, so you know, they needed as many guys as possible around Carapaz, particularly with Chris Froome not in the best possible form. But I think they missed a trick on some days. They, you know, there was one day, for example, well, on stage 16, where Roglic gained 6 seconds by finishing second behind Magnus Cort, where Ineos had actually been pulling pretty much all day, and they'd made sure the break didn't go to the finish. And you know, 48 seconds that Roglic gained overall, that's the equivalent of a 30 kilometer time trial, of what he would gain in a 30 kilometer time trial. So I think teams, particularly when Roglic is in the equation, and they need to start thinking about this more, and they need to start picking a team and tailoring their tactics to prevent him from getting time bonuses. But again, this adds another layer to the narrative of a Grand Tour, and I think it's absolutely fascinating. And it amazes me, and I think it does come from this puritanical desire for the strongest physical guy to win. It amazes me that people want to do away with them. And I do wonder how much of it comes from just a dislike of Roglic, not in the case of the listener who asked the question on this occasion, but in some cases.
Yeah, I agree with you completely, Daniel. I mean, if you think back to, certainly the Giro has had big time bonuses on offer over the years. I think in the 80s, there was certainly a Giro that Giuseppe Saroni won, where some stages had a 30-second time bonus. And I'd go back to that occasionally. I think that the sport has to keep evolving, has to keep throwing a different type of challenge at the teams and riders. Otherwise, we've seen it before, it settles into a rut. The Grand Tours do settle into a rut. And, you know, one year, I'm not necessarily saying every year, but, you know, you could have on, say, the six big stages in the mountains, you could offer, instead of 10 seconds, you know, 6 and 4, you could offer 20, 10 and 6, or 30 whatever, you know, you could offer much bigger time bonuses that would really, you know, what's the aim of the Tour de France, the Giro and the Vuelta? It's to get eyeballs on watching on the screen, isn't it? And if you had a mountain stage, which, you know, on the Angliru, for example, there's an absolute monster time bonus on offer, everyone's going to tune in to watch that and see what impact it has on the race. Now, it might not have any impact on the race. Exactly what you're saying, Daniel, might happen. It might be in somebody's interest to try and get a break up the road by 10, 12 minutes so that the time bonus is snapped up before the GC riders get there. But I think just to mix things up and keep everyone on their toes, I'm not saying announce it the week before the race, but at the start of the year when the courses are announced, to unveil things that will get people thinking differently. And the teams that adapt to different tactical requirements will prevail. I also, you know, the Tour de France isn't necessarily just a test of the strongest physical rider. It's a mental challenge and a tactical one as well.
Absolutely right, Napalm. And I think you have to create this integration between the battle for the stage win and the GC. You know, ring fencing one or the other and saying, well, you know, what's going on down the road, 5 minutes down the road, bears no relevance to what's going on in the peloton. I just don't think it's good for spectacle. It's not good for in terms of initiating an interesting and new audience, because it's difficult to understand. It's difficult to make any sense of it. It's difficult to explain. And I think, you know, again, what was great about the Vuelta was that integration where all the moving parts bore some relation to each other.
Well, Lionel, that was part two of our press conference episode after the Grandest Tour. Lots and lots of questions. We didn't get through all of them, but we did get through most of them, I think, and very enjoyable. It was some interesting questions, and it was nice to be able to get at the start of the this episode Alexander Christoph and Mitch Docker to answer one of them.
Yeah, whether we answered the question satisfactorily, I don't know. Some of our answers veered off into ramble territory, but, well, there we are. That's the way it is. It's been a long season, hasn't it, in a funny way? It's been
a long year, yeah. I noticed Ruth Winder... there was a reminder of her Tour Down Under success on Twitter, and she couldn't believe that happened this year. The Tour Down Under does seem like a long, long time ago.
It does, and we've done four Grand Tours in effect, haven't we, really? Giro, the Tour de France, and then the Grandest Tour, which 5 weeks marathon. It's strange to think that the racing has only just finished, and yet Christmas is around the corner, and then it'll be the new year, and who knows what the 2021 racing calendar will look like, certainly at the beginning.
Who knows? At the start of the episode, we give you a bit of a reminder about the Friends of the Podcast subscription, I think we call it now. You can sign up at any time, of course, and if you sign up today, you'll get a year's access. It won't run out in December, but a lot of you will come up for renewal from December onwards. And yeah, we're very grateful to you for your support. And if you pay a little bit extra, £50 or £100, you can get your choice of a tea towel with a beautiful design or a casquette also with a beautiful design. And if you pay £100, you can get both. And we'll have details, won't we, in the new year, Lionel, about how you can purchase those items if you're a friend of the podcast.
Absolutely, we will. Next week's episode will be my chat with Alan Piper, sports director at UAE Team Emirates, who was in the car behind Tadej Pogacar on La Planche des Belles Filles when the young Slovenian turned the Tour de France on its head. So that will be next week's regular episode. In the meantime, Mitch Docker's final episode of the year is coming on Wednesday. That is his chat with Svein Tuft. In fact, Mitch is answering the questions in that one. And Explore returns at the end of the week as well. So listen out for those.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thanks, Rich.